This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. David Daniel has won more accolades, both for teaching and for contributions to neuroscience, than we can possibly list. But here's two: the Transforming Education Through Neuroscience Award and being voted America's hottest college professor 2 years running. There's even a professional side to what he knows about making people laugh. Yet when it comes to improving education, Dr. Daniel is nothing but serious. This research psychologist believes study of how the brain works can lead to improvements in classroom education, but he also says classroom teachers have much to tell brain scientists, and it's about time those scientists listen. Intrigued? Then let me also mention our guest has come prepared to dispel some of the most common myths about how the brain works. And after he does, you might just realize you're smarter than you knew. We'll find out right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. What science has discovered so far about how the brain works, and what, if anything, that has to do with teaching. As mentioned at the top of the hour, our guest has been collecting impressive accolades for many years now from impressive organizations: the American Psychological Association, the Learning and Brain Foundation, the Princeton Review, just to name a few. But the honor that seems to really catch people's attention is the polling done by RateMyProfessor.com that has named him America's hottest college professor for the second year in a row. He is a professor of psychology at James Madison University, Dr. David Daniel. Welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thank you very much.
What makes someone a great teacher?
I think the ultimate answer to that question really is if the students learn. And then you could add to it if they're happy about doing it. I think we've been overly prescriptive trying to say what good teaching and bad teaching is. Related to stand-up comedy. There's hyper comedians, there's soft-spoken comedians, there's ones who dance around, there's ones who sit still. If the audience laughs, they're a comedian. If they're not, they're a lecturer. There's all kinds of teachers. They work in their own style, in their own context. If they master that context and they get the response they're supposed to get, which is student learning, they're a teacher. Otherwise, they're just a lecturer too.
Much of your work, David Daniel, has been trying to connect the worlds of science, at least those aspects of science that study how the human brain works and theories about how learning happens, and classrooms, the profession of teaching. What is it that you think it might be good for most people to understand about those connections that maybe many of us don't understand?
There's several things. First off, we're not there yet. If anybody tells you that the brain does this, therefore we should teach this way, they're very premature with respect to the science. We know more about how the mind works. Concepts like memory, you know, those sorts of things. We've been studying those for years. We've been studying the brain for years, but with the new technology, people are more excited about it because you can see things. With the mind, you really can't see things. So cognitive psychology is a much more fertile area for possible to leverage for classroom interventions. The brain stuff usually backs up or questions or tries to find out where the cognitive functions happen. There are instances where the brain science is really making inroads, in particular at the tail ends. You know, so severe ADHD, severe dyslexias, things that look very different on a scan so we could zero in on them. But my main caution would be we're not there yet. It's just interesting right now. We need to distinguish between provocative and useful if we're going to take things into the classroom. Provocative is neat. It gets you thinking. It gets you excited. It makes you wonder. It's neat, right? That doesn't mean it gives you anything in your hand that you should go and do with children. There's no evidence that this leads to this thing, and if you do this thing, children learn better. The only evidence you need is, does it work for what you need it to work for?
Can you give me some specific examples
of
things that end up being used in a classroom, or that education policymakers say we should do this because science says this is how the brain works?
Actually, I'll give you an example from Virginia. I was called a few years ago to a school. A teacher had gone to one of those you know, 3-day conferences on the brain, and she had come back, just changed her entire teaching. A year and a half later, her kids were at the top of the school. The principal called me up and said, hey, could you come here and help us put this in a bottle so our other teachers could benefit from this? This is an incredible turnaround for this teacher. So I went in, very excited, actually, to see what was going on. And the chapter she was, there was a particular chapter she was pointing to for everything. Someone told her that the brain needs water. So she was having the kids drink a lot of water, which she ended up in a lot of restroom breaks too. She was having them do exercises because the brain needs blood. She was putting a turnip on the desk some days, and the kids were told not to touch it all day long because part of the brain will sense novelty and they'll stay attentive all day long. Most of the things she was doing were junk science. They were just things that workshop people had taken an isolated study from the brain, overgeneralized, and tried to package and sell. But her teaching had gotten better results than it ever had. And the reason is, when I talk to her, she says, for the first time in 15 years, I'm excited about my teaching. So what we have here is a teacher who got engaged in teaching again. The actual interventions have proven to have very little to no effect, sometimes a negative effect, on learning. But her re-engagement, her enthusiasm, the things that she did to make those things work, that got results. The extrapolations from science had nothing to do with it.
I wonder, David, if you know of other examples of things that maybe teachers who are listening have heard too, that have become sort of common in that, well, neuroscientists have determined, or people studying the brain have decided, that this is how the brain works, so this is what you should do to take advantage of it in the classroom.
Oh, there's a bunch. There's an area called neuromyths, which you can Google and get lists of things that are like that. One is that we only use 5 to 10% of our brain, which is a metaphor, is you're not living up to your potential. It's not a bad metaphor to get people to stretch. But does neuroscientists say we only use 5 to 10% of our brain? No. That there's no basis for that whatsoever. There's an entire website trying to figure out where that came from. Left brain, right brain. That's a metaphor for individual differences. So what's happening is the brain science is coming out with certain findings, and then it's being taken as metaphor and moving into classroom, moving away from data and moving into bigger sorts of things. Left brain, right brain, kids are different. You can't just teach them all math, reading, and science and call that education. That was taken at a time when that was being pushed on us, and people were saying, we need more arts, we need to be more creativity, we need those things. And the left brain, right brain became very, very popular in education. Is it true? Not at that level, not at all.
Backing up a little bit, Dr. David Daniel, you said a few minutes ago something about the difference between how the brain works and how the mind works. Some people see brain and mind as being the same thing. What's the difference in your mind? Or in your brain?
Well, that's actually a philosophical question for the most part. I just was in a workshop in Peru where one of the science philosophers was addressing this exact same thing. So I'm going to skirt that issue philosophically and talk about levels of analysis. All right. Whatever the brain does manifests thoughts and mind. All right, it's the material basis for that. Okay, those thoughts are and reactions to the world are lots of parts of the brain working together simultaneously to create those things. That cognition can guide behavior. From a teacher's point of view, I can't see the brain yet. We may someday have little MRIs at the desks. I don't know. We can't see that. I can't see the mind, but I can infer it from behavior. So what I know about memory, did they memorize it? How do I know? Are they enthusiastic? How do I know? All those sorts of things. Mind is the next layer down that a teacher can leverage to do this. We have hundreds of years of data on the mind.
I was thinking you might have more on that. I mean, hundreds of years of data
on how the brain works together to create thought memories, those sorts of things. Now, the material basis for a memory, it could be a bunch of networks, all nodes all working together that are recruited to, to reconstruct something that you think might have happened in the past. That's how the brain does that. But what you're aware of is mind.
Managing editor of the academic journal Mind, Brain, and Education, past executive director of the International Mind, Brain, and Education Society, and professor of psychology at James Madison University, Dr. David Daniel is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. So to you listening in, if you are now or have ever been a classroom teacher, what do you want scientists to study that might be helpful to the teaching profession? If you are now or have ever been a parent, what do you want scientists to study that might be helpful to your children's efforts at learning? You can reach us on Facebook, where we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Let's talk about what may be the most controversial area of science, study of the brain, and then jumps to teaching approaches, sometimes referred to as the whole learning styles phenomenon.
Yeah. So let me be clear to everybody out there. I'm really coming at this from a teacher who speaks the language of science. I can analyze, understand neuroscience. I do some neuroscience. I do mostly cognitive science. I work on how to improve student performance in terms of learning and motivation, things like that. So when I'm talking about learning styles, it's a very interesting thing because I know what teachers mean when they say it. I also know what scientists mean when they say it, and they don't mean the same thing. So a learning style might be, for example, that students have certain ways that they learn best. Not that they prefer to learn best. A true learning styles theory says they learn better this way. For example, visual, auditory, kinesthetic. Those are the things that most people hear about. Now, to a scientist, that infers a hypothesis that if I can determine this kid's learning style, teach them in that modality, and then maybe assess them in that modality, they should perform better. They should learn better. And there has never been good science to prove that that's true. On the other hand, teachers believe in learning styles. When they hear the word learning styles, again, they hear individual differences. So as a scientist, when I tell a teacher learning styles don't exist, they're saying, well, from a scientist's perspective, maybe not, but I see my kids every day and they're not all the same. Science would agree. Science just it has not been able to give you the words to say this is how the kids are different. Teachers can give us those words. Imagine how rich the language of individual difference would be if teachers had developed the vocabulary for what they're seeing in their classroom. Instead, they've pulled theories that weren't developed for the classroom, like learning styles, multiple intelligences, things like that, and adapted that vocabulary to try to describe what they see. But it's a lot like wearing a suit that doesn't fit. A teacher's experience is much more rich. And those categories break down pretty quickly.
When I hear, David, most people talk about learning styles, it seems to me that they're talking about somebody being most likely to learn most effectively through visual stimuli, that they're a visual learner or an auditory learner,
yeah,
or auditory or tactile learner. And that's what you're talking about, but you think that that's not what's actually happening.
I'm pretty sure. I don't just think it.
And yet there are teachers listening right now who probably will jump up and down in objection to what they're hearing from you because they believe that from their experience, when they separate out different students in their class and approach some that they think are auditory learners different from how they approach what they think of as visual learners, they get better results. So I'm going to ask you to address that when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. David Daniel was awarded the Learning and Brain Foundation's 2013 award for transforming education through neuroscience, a Teaching Excellence Award from the American Psychological Association, as well as named Professor of the Year by students at James Madison University. The director of the Harvard Mind, Brain, and Education Program has called Dr. Daniel's efforts critically important to connecting the work of teachers and researchers around the world. David, I was going to ask you more about learning styles, but I think we've got somebody on the phone who's going to do just that. So let's go to Nancy and find out. Nancy, you're calling from Harrisonburg.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I was interested in differences in learning styles. I loved algebra, but not chemistry, things that where you just repeat back information. I feel that people don't understand the way my mind works. I learn very rapidly to solve problems. And as a matter of fact, I did an independent study in psychology at James Madison and did very well on that. And I think it was because it was an independent study rather than just repeating something that was presented to me.
That's actually a perfect experience to kind of exemplify what I've been saying. You figured out how you best could learn the material in front of you, and you did it. You didn't have to fit into a category. Maybe one day you thought you would learn this way, in a different mood you learned a different way, depending on what was going on with you and with the kind of material in front of you. That kind of complexity is something that science isn't really good at right now, but you're exemplifying it in your question.
Well, thank you. Do you have any advice to give to someone with this learning style where I get curious and delve into things? And I love doing that.
I'd say make more of you. I would love to have a classroom full of students who got curious and delve into things in their free time.
Oh, great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Nancy, thanks so much for your call. So what I was mentioning before the break, Dr. David Daniel, is those teachers who feel very strongly that when they have made the effort with the children in their classroom to approach different kids with different learning styles based on what the teacher believes he or she has discovered about whether somebody is a visual learner or a kinesthetic learner or an auditory learner, that their students do better. And your response to that is?
I wonder if they do better because you've put them into a pigeonhole and teaching that pigeonhole, or because you're teaching in a richer style that's more accessible to them in general. One of the nice things about people who think about learning styles or think about multiple intelligences is they're thinking about how can I teach in a way that more students can access and benefit from what I'm doing. So they end up teaching in a richer way. Think about it. Children have to construct knowledge. You don't just shove it in their head. And in the end, a learning style theory is a way to figure out how do I shove this in their head. They have to actively go out, like she said, be curious or be motivated somehow, and build that knowledge. You know, another metaphor from brain science is we actually literally build connections between synapses to represent knowledge. Kids are constructing knowledge. How do we get them to do that? One way might work with a bunch of kids, but not all of them. If you could teach in a richer way that's more accessible to people who are doing that work, the construction of knowledge, you're going to be more successful. And is there really just 7 kinds of kids or 8 kinds of kids? Or is a really good teacher the one that's adapting to the kid in front of them, not putting them in a different category?
David, I'm reminded of the many decades ago when I was taking some social psychology courses in college, and it seemed to me that there was a famous study that dated back, it might have been back to the 1950s or 1960s, and I think the company was General Electric, where they were looking at trying to get their workers in factories to be more productive. And so they experimented with lighting, and they experimented with paint colors and any number of things. But they found over time that no matter what colors they changed the walls of the factory or how much brighter the lights were or how much dimmer the lights were, that the productivity of the workers continued to rise. And what these researchers who were studying this finally came to as a conclusion was workers were feeling attended to, that there was all this effort going in to try and make their work environment better, and that was what was causing the improvements. Is there something here that translates to the classroom about if teachers are trying to attend to a student's learning style, even if from many people's point of view who study cognitive psychology, there really is nothing to the learning style phenomenon. But just attending to that results in a teacher being more effective because the kids feel...
Let's take that a different way. If you take a test and I find out you're a kinesthetic learner, now how would I teach lots of things in a kinesthetic fashion? Number one. All right. But I put you into that style and I keep you in that style. And that's not your style because they don't exist. And I don't teach you in a rich fashion, but I teach you in a very rigid fashion based upon the score you got on a test that isn't valid. I may be doing harm. So the teachers who do this best are the ones who decide, again, I'm going to teach in a flexible way that's accessible to all as many children as possible. Instead of saying, okay, I'm going to teach one way to this kid, one way to that kid, one way to this kid. That doesn't seem to have very, very good effects on learning. So the Hawthorne effect affected the employees because they were being attended to. Learning styles and brain science and things like that affects the teachers because they have a vocabulary, a methodology. They have something that's getting them engaged and being purposeful in their teaching. And that enthusiasm and that engagement is what will have the benefits. Learning styles. Unless you do it very flexibly, that theory specifically will not help you be a better teacher. What you derive from it in terms of flexibility and accessibleness, that could make you a better teacher.
Research psychologist David Daniel is our guest. Much of Dr. Daniel's work focuses on links between cognitive psychology and teaching practices. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And to you listening, we've titled today's broadcast, What Teachers Can Learn from Brain Scientists and What Brain Scientists Can Learn from Teachers. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. David Daniel, you've mentioned a few times now the phrase multiple intelligences. And if I recall correctly, this goes back to something many years ago postulated by, was it Dr. Garner at Harvard?
Howard Gardner.
At Harvard. And in your view, David, this is actually an example of how something starts out in one area of science where considering it may be legitimate, but somebody decides to take it and skew it and try and squeeze it into classroom approaches where it just doesn't belong.
Yeah. When Dr. Gardner wrote his first book, he was talking to psychologists. He was trying to argue that there's not one intelligence. This, you know, the G, the IQ that we commonly refer to as the number that is intelligence. But in fact, based on several criteria, there are multiple intelligences that are quite independent from each other. So what he was arguing was that for independent domains of intelligence, as opposed to one global intelligence, that was leveraged in education, again, as a metaphor for individual differences. Has Howard Gardner ever said these are the 7 or 9 kinds of intelligences, and if you find the right one for each child, they will learn better? No, he's actually gone against that.
What is it that you have seen people try to do in classrooms that sort of misappropriates the multiple intelligences theories?
Same thing as learning styles. People use them interchangeably a lot of time in education, just depending on which version you want to follow and say you're doing. His initial book had 7 kinds of intelligence. They were saying we have to teach to all 7 kinds of intelligences. Then they were trying to create tests, which you could find on websites all over the place to find your dominant intelligence. Then teachers were trying to say, hey, this is their dominant intelligence. We should teach to that. I was a visiting scholar at Harvard, and I was in one of Howard's classes. A young lady raised her hand and said, could you use more PowerPoint? And he said, let's unpack that. Why would you like me to use more PowerPoint? She said, because I'm a visual learner. And he goes, what does that mean? Well, visual learner, PowerPoint, duh, was the response he got. And he looked at her and he said, well, if you think you're a visual learner, I'll talk more so you can cultivate other talents. There's an interaction with culture. There's an interaction with your context. It's a very, very complex, complex theory.
Next call coming in from Broadway. Bill, thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for research psychologist David Daniel, please.
Hi. I'm really intrigued by the whole conversation. And I have some experience in teaching that I thought I'd throw out there. I don't do this very often. In grad school, I was studying all the different learning styles, and I put together a battery of tests that I gave to all 110 of my high school students. And in that process, I do believe that it was beneficial for me as a teacher because it did make me pay greater attention to their needs, and it seemed to have me seeking out more creative ways to approach the subject matter. But through that process, I also concluded something that I thought was could contribute to this conversation, and that's that getting all that information on all those students was profound, but it was also, from my experience, less significant information or had less impact on the classroom than who the kids sat next to. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about it, so I'll just shut up and let you talk.
Well, don't shut up yet. Tell me what you mean by who they sat next to gave you really good information.
It's really important to understand the learning needs of a particular individual, but a lot of the pedagogical approach is to individualize instruction, and when you're dealing with 25, 30 kids in a classroom, the dynamic of the classroom is as significant or even more so. And that understanding what I started looking into is sociometry. It goes back to, I guess his name was Mercer back in the 20s, but it just the idea of that, and a group of kids that have been together, many of them since first grade, who are in 11th, know each other really well. And when they come into a classroom, they have interactions that are from outside the classroom, and that those impact their learning as much as anything. And that if you're doing everything you can to individualize instruction, who they sit next to might have a bigger impact than anything.
That's a profound thought. We sometimes minimize the complex context that teaching takes place in. And what you're recognizing is that there's a social context where all this thing's happening. And the teacher's actually part of it. It's not just who they're sitting next to. It's who they're sitting in front of. And you're guiding.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The proximity.
Exactly. And you're guiding that interaction. And to just teach to a brain instead of a child, you might not think about that social context. You might not think of the other things going on if they're tired, if all these different things that are going on a daily basis in the classroom. Science isn't really good at capturing right now because we're still getting the big things down.
Yeah, that was the focus of what I started working on. But the idea of sociometry was a useful concept. That's basically looking at that dynamic, and it was interesting.
Yeah, it sounds very interesting.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I'm enjoying this show.
Well, thank you for calling.
Thank you very much, Bill. You mentioned a little while ago, Dr. David Daniel, that there are a number of myths, and I think there are four or five that you consider the most popular about how intelligence works or how the brain works. And one of them that I'm sure everybody has heard is that human beings never use more than 10% of our brain power. And David, you sent me a whole bunch of articles to prepare for today's conversation.
Yeah,
and I recall in reading one of them, some speculation that some of this mythology about the human brain, that we use less than 10% of it, comes from studies done with animals, rats and monkeys and some others, I think, back in the 1800s, where researchers were cutting open and removing part of the brain and finding out how much activity the animal could still engage in and how smart it still seemed to be. And by the fact that they could cut out a huge part of the brain and the animal seemed to survive and do just fine, there was this conclusion that, well, you must not need more than 10% of your brain. I'm curious what you think the damage is of something that turns out not to be based on very good science at all, but most of us wandering around thinking, well, I'm really not using anywhere near as much of my brain as I could be. Maybe I should try harder.
I don't see any damage as long as you think of it as a metaphor at all. But let's think about what really happens. Maybe your goal is to use less of your brain. Let's think about it that way. When you're first learning how to drive, remember how, or anything new, it's almost you're trying to build stuff. You're trying to make connections. Your attention's focused. Think about when you were learning how to drive and how hard it was to put your hands at 10 and 2 and look in the mirror and do this. And, you know, my daughter had to learn on a 5-speed, so I had to put the clutch in there. And all these things are going on. And now, actually, by the time you're 18, you can do your mascara, you're texting, you're doing all these things. And the driving part, you get home sometimes, you don't even remember the drive. It's so automatic. What's happened is your brain's become more efficient. It starts off using more of itself. Just like when you're trying to figure out the best way home through a field, you may take this way one day. Eventually, you figure out the pathways that are the most efficient, and you're using less of that field and less of your brain and less of your attention to do things. So we're always trying to balance plasticity, which is our ability to adapt, with efficiency. And we become more efficient by definition. You're using less.
We have this question on Facebook. Let me read it. We may need to wait until after the break to get your full answer. But this is from Rona, who says, what does brain research tell us about the pros and cons of using technology in learning and teaching? Technology is being treated as a magic pill for the ills of education. I teach writing and research. In the last few years, my students seem to have more trouble using information appropriately now that they so readily have access to so much information. The ease of data gathering seems to undermine thinking or curiosity.
How long do we have for that one?
You've got a minute and then more minutes after we get back from the break.
Let's start off with some general things. Brain science isn't going to tell us a whole lot about that directly, although a gentleman named Jay Geed, who's NIH, some of you may know him, who did all the frontal lobe research in teenagers. It's very, very popular. He's looking specifically at this, amongst others. But this gets into multitasking. It gets into lots of other things we do have good research on. Multitasking is what our students seem to be very proficient at. And it turns out we don't really multitask. They get very proficient switching from one task to the other more and more quickly. And there's some costs to that.
So we'll hear more about that. We'll hear parts B, C, D, and E, I suspect,
yes,
also, to Rona's question. And for you listening, if you want to join the conversation, we've got some phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. After we complete the answer to Rona's question, I think Alan in West Virginia is going to be our next caller. We'll be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Managing editor of the academic journal Mind, Brain, and Education, past executive director of the International Mind, Brain, and Education Society, and professor of psychology at James Madison University, Dr. David Daniel is our guest. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. David, Rona's question about technology, education, learning.
All right, so technology has been a panacea that people have been saying is going to impact education for years. Scrolls were technology. All right. Books were technology. Edison said that it was going to replace the teacher, that television was going to replace the teacher. So technology, what's interesting about technology is it hasn't really changed the way we do things, just the medium. I'm still waiting for technology to change the way we do things. So when we're talking about technology, one of the first things you want to look at is something called cognitive load. Right? If I have to interact on something new, a technology, maybe it's very busy or something I'm not used to doing, I have to think about how to navigate that and how to learn at the same time. And that takes away the resources away from learning. I can't trash technology. Some technology is really, really effective at learning. Others are premature. For example, electronic textbooks. There's some good data on there showing that electronic textbooks in, say, high school through college aren't as efficient a learning tool as what they're replacing. I don't think they should be in classrooms until they can be proven to be as effective as what they're replacing. So each technology.
Would you like to argue a little bit with U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan, who came out a couple of years ago? And
Dan Willingham, I actually wrote an editorial in Science addressing the premature pushing of technology before it's been proven to work for children in the classroom.
Because he said that he thought textbooks ought to be replaced by
right. And he could have said that and then funded research to make them so that they can replace them as better or at least equivalent learning tools.
Or fund research to find out if they would be better?
Right. They would be better. And the research right now shows they're not.
Tell us a little bit about that research. How is a tablet less efficacious for learning than a book?
One of the main ways is efficiency. Right? Then let's make sure we're distinguishing between a textbook and, say, a novel. We read them for very different reasons, with very different outcomes and very different styles. Electronic textbooks seem to be pretty ubiquitously, and all the research that's been done on this shows that they take longer to read, and there's more subjective fatigue in the reader when they're done. So you're reading slower, and you're more tired. So it takes you longer to get to the same learning and more effort to get to the same learning outcome. That's the biggest finding. There's also all these clickable links and things like that. The more of them in there, there's a one study that showed the more of them in there, the worse the learning outcomes. We keep thinking the more stuff, the better. Maybe the more stuff, the less you have to read. And the casualty might be the actual reading itself. Electronic textbooks have a lot of promise, but we have to build them so that they do their job. And it may not be copying the paper textbook is the best way to do this. There might be another way these have to be designed. The other thing is just the fact that how tempting it. Think about it. If any of you are out there are in front of your computer right now while you're listening to the show, how hard it is for you to not check your Facebook, your email, or do something else while you're listening. It's very difficult for students to not do something else and check every once in a while and take these breaks to do that when the thing they're supposed to be reading is on the thing they're used to doing all the social activity on.
So to you on the other side of your radio, do you care to double check if what you've heard about how the human brain works is in fact backed up by scientific evidence? Wonder if some of the things you've heard other people say about the brain might actually be more myth than reality? You can reach us on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Alan in Lost City, Virginia, West Virginia, called us. Alan, thank you for doing that. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Hello. I have gotten fired up about the idea of neuroscience and education since about the mid-1990s. My approach it as a classroom teacher. Right now, I've got so many topics I could like to ask you about, but I'm going to narrow it to two that seem to be related, and it's connected to what you were saying about electronic textbooks. As an English teacher, I ask my students to annotate the book, to go through it and make, notes in the margins and things like that. And they do something that is analogous to that. But I've found that when they're searching the book to find a particular quotation or to track the development of a particular theme, they flip pages in the book. They skim it. They are hunting for that information. And when they do, their eye travels down the page, and they build a much deeper contextual understanding of where that information appears, not just of the discrete information itself. And I've found that when they use their computers to do that, all they have to do is make two keystrokes, and they get a list of all the isolated incidents where a particular character makes a speech or something like that. And so they lose that experience of flipping through those pages and assembling this three-dimensional view of the development of an idea. That's my opinion. But related to that is the idea of long-term potentiation and rote learning. And I know rote learning has received a lot of bad press. And my feeling about it is, from what I know about long-term potentiation, that it seems to dovetail with rote learning in some situations. And I was wondering if you might be able to make a comment about that.
Actually, I'd like you just to expand briefly about what you mean by long-term potentiation, how it dovetails.
Well, because my feeling is that when you are flipping through these books, what I was saying before, and you're developing that, you're repeating your experience with that information multiple times. Even if it's not specifically what you're looking for, if your eye glances down a page, oh, yes, this incident happened before that incident. I remember that now. You know, and it, as I say, it builds this three-dimensional appreciation for the idea as it appears, but it builds it because you are reviewing as you're searching. As you flip through the pages, you encounter a particular scene, you know, coming through the book forward, then coming through it backward as you, you know. Are you following what I'm saying here?
Yeah. And I'm following what you're saying. And I'm really interested in the way you're describing it, because the way you're describing it, from a science point of view, is a hypothesis. You could actually test that, give them materials that don't have all those contextual cues versus ones that do, and see if learning is better in one condition over the other. The fact of the matter is, you don't have to go back to brain science at all. Teaching is a very pragmatic pursuit. You need to know if it works and have an explanation why that is something that will help you help guide your practice. Long-term potentiation or anything else from the brain, knowing this lobe or that lobe, isn't going to help guide your practice as much as broader, more specific concepts. So you have a wonderful theory that's actually, there's been a few studies that I know that have tested that. There's a number of things about students being hunters and gatherers when it comes to textbooks and using cues. They also like to look at the page and see how far they have left to read. They like doing that back and forth. And what that does, and every time they turn the page, it gives their eyes a rest. They don't get that eye rest on the computer. So there's a whole lot of things inherent to what you're saying that might make for a better experience for the students are giving themselves in that. I don't know that you have to go back to brain research at all to get that. Brain research can infer a hypothesis. The hypothesis for a practice needs to be tested. And you're without the brain research, you have a hypothesis for practice. It's just a matter of testing that and seeing if it works, then sharing it with people so that they can benefit from your experience.
Yes. I was thinking of the long-term potentiation more in the context of learning that requires memorization. From what I understand about long-term potentiation, it's produced largely through repetition, where the neurons fire repeated times, and then you grow the additional connection that makes it a kind of a hardwired connection between two neurons. Am I out in left field on this?
Oh no, that's a good model. It's what I'm saying is that may not be the mechanism that it actually really happens, but it's a good model to use. Rote learning, for example, it does work, but there's a cost sometimes. And it sucks the soul out of learning. So when you're doing those sort of memorization, you have to encourage the learner to actually build the knowledge that comes from it, and that you have to attend to their emotional needs, motivation, and things like that. And so rote memorization rote memorization is foundational to higher levels of knowledge. Okay. Not rote, let's say memorization. How are you going to build a higher level unless you know what the words mean, for example? If that's your only goal is rote memorization, that might be a problem. But it's foundational. The question is, how do you get students to benefit from that without sucking the soul out of learning and discouraging them from engaging in it?
Yes. I wasn't really thinking of it in terms of a dominant method of learning, but there are occasions where you run into a need for just that sort of plowing through it sort of thing. I imagine that law school and med school have a lot of that.
Right,
Alan.
Exactly.
Great points. Thank you so much for your call. Dr. David Daniel, long before you got a PhD in research psychology, you were studying for undergraduate psychology work at San Diego State University. Mm-hmm. And you and I only discovered this in preparing for today's show. You and I were both studying at San Diego State at the same time in the mid-80s.
Yeah.
I was majoring in history. You were majoring in psychology, but I was taking lots of psychology courses. So although those departments are different ends of the campus, we probably passed each other every once in a while. I bring this up because around the time you were finishing up your undergrad work, you started another career, what turned out to be a very successful career, that you went back and forth between work as a stand-up comedian and continuing to study in academics, getting a master's degree, eventually getting a PhD, teaching at different schools around the country. And at one point, as I understand the story, David, when you were kind of at the top of your game as a comedian, playing the nightclubs all around Detroit, you decided that you had a passion for helping those in the poorest environs get some better access to education.
Yes.
And you ended up going to, I think it was a Sioux Indian reservation?
Yep, Laurel Sioux Reservation, South Dakota.
And you helped found a college there.
There's a wonderful tribal college system in this country. That was one of them.
I guess I got to ask you, David, how much your passion today about trying to get people to better understand what works in the classroom and what doesn't, what the limitations of brain science are when trying to apply what we're learning about how the human brain works to learning in a classroom, is connected to this sense that you have that people who are poor and disadvantaged in this country need better access to education.
Well, it's completely intertwined. Like I say, teaching is a practical pursuit. It's pragmatic. You don't go and just do stuff to people. And if it works, it works. It doesn't. Your kid gets one shot at that algebra class. Your kid gets one shot at that. You could see the life going out of kids' eyes fourth or fifth grade if they're not in a good experience and they're checking out. And underserved areas like that have a lot of stresses outside of the classroom as well. It's just a very, very, it's actually becoming increasingly important to understand what really works as opposed to what should work or could work. And get the science to what does work and get teachers to focus on what does work and sharing it with each other and trying it out in different contexts and building their knowledge base so that our kids get the best experience possible and a flexible experience that adapts to their context so that they can benefit from it after school, not just during school.
What questions should teachers be asking?
I think that teachers, if they're going to science, and it's, actually, this is for policymakers, too. I think there's like four or so questions. When you hear something from brain science or cognitive science or someone says, this makes sense, you should do this. The first question is are the findings credible? Usually they come from a peer-reviewed journal, so that's not an issue. Second question is the interpretation of the finding credible? Sometimes we could find out from a medical journal that a certain mineral has certain effects on the human body. And then people will make a supplement and say it does this because it's evidence-based. Evidence-based doesn't have to be true. It's based. I need evidence demonstrated. So is their interpretation valid of what was going on? And have they been proven to get the results they want with children like yours and contexts like yours? You know, when I was working on the reservations, we have a rural population. We have a culturally different population, a very distinct population in terms of how they approach the world. I couldn't leverage a lot of education research to try to figure out what's the best thing to do here. We had to work with teachers who were successful and try to figure it out. And it turns out it did map onto science pretty well. But I couldn't say when I went to one of these big teacher conferences where I'm hearing a bunch of private school people talk about what works with their kids where they have lots of resources. Does it work in a place like where I work? Or do I have to work really hard to adapt it? Are there undesirable side effects? My analogy is to medicine, all right? Like I said, with drilling can work. It's not that it can't, but there's possible side effects. For example, it could make it really, really unmotivating. So are there, the more technology you use, it doesn't involve reading. Is the side effect not learning how to read as well? Or not enjoying reading because they'd rather be doing something with the mouse on their computer. And the last thing is, doesn't really work for you in your context. That's something the teacher has to try. One of the things I think teachers should do is really ask themselves, can I take the time to figure out if this works before I commit 100% to it? Can I, we don't like control groups as teachers. We don't like some kids not getting something we're excited about. But until it's proven to work, why would I lose this on all the kids? I need to be tweaked first.
So, the analogy, the medicine, in your mind, is we don't put a pill on the market until it's been tested and the hypothesis that was behind it is found to work. You think we should do the same thing in education?
Yes, and science is not making the pill. teachers are the ones who have to take science and try to figure out how to make it work. Scientists are not doing a good job of that.
Our guest has been Dr. David Daniel, professor of psychology at James Madison University and managing editor of the journal Mind, Brain, and Education. David, thank you so very much for your time.
Thank you.
Podcasts of this program available on the Virginia Insight tab at WMRA.org. When you get to the page for today's broadcast, you will see links to more information about Dr. Daniel and the work he's doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.